Tensions have eased in Ferguson, Missouri after nearly 2 weeks of protests and police action following a police officer's fatal shooting of an unarmed African-American teen. We will hear from two law enforcement guests about what happened in Ferguson and what lessons we have learned when it comes to good policing in our communities. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, August 29th. Our first guest was a listener suggestion, and we certainly thought of him as well. We have had him on the show before to talk about his book, Arrested Development, A Veteran Police Chief Sounds Off About Protest, Racism, Corruption, and the Seven Steps Necessary to Improve Our Nation's Police. He is former Madison Police Department Chief David Cooper, and we will welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. David Cooper led the Madison Police Department for more than 20 years. He blogs at improvingpolice.wordpress.com, and he joins us in our studios. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you very much for coming in. Well, things have quieted down in Ferguson, and I believe the last of the National Guard pulled out yesterday. But still, just tell me your reaction to the police response in Ferguson.
Well, this is a great tragedy plus a great opportunity. I mean, if American police don't see this as sort of the underside of policing today, they're going to be very much left out. I can't help but think back to the 1968 Kerner Commission on the Causes of Violence in America. Kerner Commission found that we have in American society, you know, two separate societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. And what I learned back in '68 was the damning kind of observation that America's police officers see their community through the windshield of a squad car and hear about its activities over a police radio. I think as a young police officer in 1968 that moved me greatly, and from that came community policing. You know, let's not see our communities through a windshield of a squad car. Let's not hear about its activity. Let's be part of the community. Let's move in. I think that we focused the last 40 years since Kerner on our major metropolitan areas. And politically, they made great strides in terms of diversity of their departments. At the same time, smaller departments have not been affected by that. And Ferguson is really a good example of a second or third tiered suburb of a large metropolitan area.
Yeah, they have, 97% white and only, I mean...
On the police department. Yeah. And the community has changed, but the police department is basically an all-white department. I think there's three women and two or three black officers on that. That can't happen in America today. We can't have that kind of non-diversification in a police department. It's a recipe for trouble. And then when the police get to see their job basically as kind of holding down, dominating a troublesome black population that's poor, that does not have jobs, you're looking for more and more trouble. And I think we have to look at the whole system there. And the New York Times has done a good job, I think, of looking at, you know, how does, I'm going to be blogging on that later this week, how does a traffic ticket get you in prison?
Yeah. Well, how does that?
Well, because you can't pay, you can't pay the freight, you can't pay the offense. You get court costs on top of that. A warrant goes out for your arrest. You're into prison or into the jail a few three or four times. You get out. You don't have a driver's license. You don't have a car. Yet you have to go out there and try to look to find a job. And then on the way, you get stopped by police. But this time, you run away. You get put back in jail again. You get another warrant for you. Once you get out. This time you struggle to get away, you end up resisting, you end up in perhaps battering a police officer, and you're in the state prison.
Yeah. Well, just initially, how could the Ferguson Police Department have done things differently?
Yeah, I mean, Okay, we learned a lot about crowds and behavior and demonstrations in Madison. I wrote about this back in the 70s and 80s. My book talks about that. What we have is the Madison method is a very soft method, a very you know, escalating, but we never start out with helmets and shields and body armor. We always start out soft, officer in blazers, dialoguing with the crowd. That's the way things work. It's worked for us, and everybody said, oh, well, that's just Madison. You guys are different. But recently, Clifford Stott in the UK did a study of British football crowds and said the soft approach to start always works. So you can't start hard. Yeah. And Ferguson started hard. And they also left a body of that young man for many hours exposed with his parents and his friends standing outside that yellow tape and didn't cover that body. And I think that was the painful incident that caused the kind of violence that we saw.
Yeah. In the wake of Ferguson, President Obama did call for a review of the distribution of military style equipment.
Yes, and that adds to it. The first approach is, armored vehicles. It looks like the Army moved in before the National Guard did.
Yeah. So, do you think that we ought to stop that program? Should we limit this military equipment that police departments get through this program?
Well, it's a very sensitive topic amongst police. It has to do with officer safety issues. But if you're going to have an armored car, it ought to be clear about what the armored car is all about and what it's for. It ought to be for protecting people. If you have somebody who is wounded and you've got an active sniper, an armored car works very good to get aid to that person.
Is this affecting how police departments police?
Sure. And I think Chief Kovols talked about that. Are we warriors or are we guardians? And I think that's the dichotomy today and the mindset of many police in America today. And that's unfortunate. Do you see yourself as a warrior out there to kind of get those bad guys who are causing the problems? Or do you see yourself as a guardian? I work with the community. What does the community want? And I'll help the community get this because we both have the same interests. When officers work with the community, when they're on foot, in constant commentary with the public, when they're working and problem solving, when officers are out there, they are more effective than a separate, distant warrior police can ever be. And secondly, they're safer.
Yeah. So, what should the Ferguson Police Department do to improve moving forward?
Well, they've got to diversify, and that's going to take years. It took us over 10 years to diversify basically white police department in Madison in the 1970s. For 20 years, I had to say that half of our recruits are going to be women and people of color. And only after 20 years did I end up with about 10 to 12% people of color in the police department and 25% women. Now, that number has gone up in the last 20 years since I've retired, and that's remarkable, and that is commendatory for the department. But you've got to diversify, you've got to have people, but you also have to have the right kind of attitudes, the right kind of training. I talk about training in my book, too. Police tend to be trained as warriors. They're not trained as guardians. Half of all the police academies in the United States are based on a stress model that kind of demeans the recruits. And it's kind of like Marine Corps boot camp that I went through years ago. But there's nothing similar between what an urban police officer does and what a Marine or a soldier does.
Yeah. Well, I'm just imagining that some may say, well, in some urban areas in Ferguson, and when looting and shooting is going on, maybe the police department is, maybe the police officers are warriors.
What I've done? Well, when you've got that kind of rioting and arson, and you've got that kind of violence, yeah, you've got to use an appropriate amount of force in there, but you don't start out with the SWAT team. I think what America needs today, and it has to really struggle with this, I think we're seeing, you know, the underbelly of America right now. This is a terrible mirror about the differences in race perception, because there's great differences between how blacks and how whites see Ferguson.
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, if you look overall, you know, how people see police is that most white people look at very positive. Oh, police officer is a helper, and they protect us and everything. But that's not the experience of black America. Black America is that police do bad things to you. They arrest people in your family. They disrespect you. They don't treat you with courtesy. So what we need to have in America, we need to have educated, trained, well-trained, smart police who are honest, who use force appropriately and look at that as a public trust, who are connected with their communities, and who respect and are civil to everybody they come in contact with.
Well, how come we don't have that right now?
Well, I think in some departments we do have that right now. But I think we have ignored the race issue for years and years and years. For those of us who are a little older and been through the civil rights movement and that, you know, we want to forget about it. But even here in Madison, where we got this race to equity report, it shows great, great disparities between the success of black and white children. If I was an African American and I read that report, I think people don't care about my children. They certainly care about their children because their children are not doing very well. But my children aren't doing very well, and we have not changed that. It's been a factor that's been in our community that we don't want to talk about in Madison, Dane County. You know, but half of our black high school students are not graduating on time. And we push that back down in terms of reading levels and things. Black Americans are not successful in the school system, and they're not being successful in our economic system unless we change that. We're going to be in for big trouble in America. And in many cases, you know, the kind of linchpin out there is how police treat people of color and poor people.
Well, we'll continue talking with David Cooper, who is the former chief of police in the city of Madison, author of Arrested Development, A Veteran Police Chief Sounds Off About Protest, Racism, Corruption, and the 7 Steps Necessary to Improve Our Nation's Police. And we're talking about how to improve our nation's police. And we're welcoming your questions and your thoughts on this at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about policing, and what does good policing look like in the wake of the violence in Ferguson, Missouri? We are talking with former Madison Police Chief David Cooper, and we're welcoming your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our lines are full, so let's go to, is it Jose in Milwaukee?
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Well, thank you, first of all, for having this conversation and also for the opportunity. I bring the perspective from an immigrant from Bolivia who became a U.S. citizen, and I'm proud to be a citizen, but I'm also alarmed to see the abuse of force and equipment by the police over the whole country, basically. That's what I keep hearing in the news. I have 2 little kids. I worry about their future. Just yesterday, there was a man killed by the police in St. Paul, and he was armed with a rock. So I think all these things should be the catalyzer of a conversation that goes beyond the racial issues, because I think it's too late for that conversation for the whole of society. And also beyond the equipment of the police, because if the police doesn't make use of their bullets and guns, there's not going to be killings by the police. Last year, according to The Economist, the U.S. had 402 people killed by the police. Germany had zero. So what does that tell you about how the police is working? Mm. So I think it's time for us to look at how the police focuses their efforts in helping society. What's the best way? Are they there to maintain violence, or are they there to maintain peace?
Thank you, Jose. A response, David Cooper?
Yeah, well, thanks, Jose, for those comments. I think you're right on target with your perceptions here. I might add to the German police thing. Last year, they used 80. The German police shot 85 times in the country. We have had shooting incidents involving police close to using that many rounds in one incident. Mm-hmm. One of the things that that Jose brought up and is a great concern of mine is how we're respecting life in this country with regard to how we do police operations. And that has to do with how police respond to unarmed and armed people, not with firearms, I'm just saying with edged weapons, with a rock, like Jose mentioned, a club. Why do those incidents result in somebody being killed? Now, I think there's other ways to handle that. I think that it's a job of a professional to be creative in responses. There's other ways to handle people who have blunt or edged weapons without the end result them being shot and killed. And there's just been too many of those incidents across the country right now. And I'm going to be blogging on this later this week about we've got to be more creative in how we respond to these situations, which are often someone who is mentally ill, who is intoxicated, drugs or alcohol, or who is, you know, incredibly distraught for the situation. There are better ways to handle that. And there's also ways to keep officers safe and still not result in the death of the person that they're trying to help.
Yeah. Thank you, Jose. Let's go next to Daryl in Milwaukee. Hello, Daryl.
Hello, how are you? I was just calling because I agree totally with your guest. As an African-American male, and I would consider myself middle class, I've had both positive and negative encounters with the police. The negative encounters have definitely been a result of racial profiling, and it has kind of changed my view of police. I think you only really need that one or two negative times to kind of shed a kind of a bad light on the police department, unfortunately. But I guess what I wanted to kind of ask is as far as with mental illness, because I actually work in education. So sometimes we've had to deal with students that have been kind of irate, and we know that they have an illness. I know police have less deadly uses of force that they can use. Why don't they use it?
I'm sorry, why don't they use what, Daryl?
Why don't they use, like, the tasers
other
things, less deadly, you know.
Deadly force is used far too often, he thinks.
Yeah, well, that's a good comment. That's exactly what I'm talking about. The problem with the taser has been, even though that was going to be sort of the lifesaver mechanism, if we outfit police with tasers, then they won't have to shoot people. I think there's a general feeling amongst in the field, and I might be wrong today, but I base this on still having to use firearms, even after tasers have been used, that they're not as effective as we would like them to be. But are there other restraining methods? And that's the whole question. I mean, that's what we expect from our professionals, to, if things are not working well, for them to fix it. And that's why, you know, my constant talk about continuous improvement of it's a lifelong, career-long endeavor to improve things. With your comment, I just read a little piece here. This came from a young man by the name of Shane Claiborne, who is one of this new monastics group, that young people of faith who are moving into poor communities and working with the people to make life better there. Shane writes this. He said recently on his blog, 20 years ago, if you asked me if I think police treat people fairly, and by the way, Shane is white, fairly, regardless of race, I would have said confidently yes, just like 70% of white folks in the recent Pew survey. In fact, 30 years ago, if you'd asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I'd say a policeman. I grew up in a small town in Tennessee, which was still very segregated. Growing up, we knew the police officers by name. On more than one occasion, the police had saved the day, and countless news stories celebrated the heroism and courage of police officers. He goes on, I moved to Philadelphia in 1993, and I quickly began to see the world differently with new lens. My experiences with police have not been entirely negative, but each negative experience shattered my world, and I felt like a betrayal of trust. Instinctively, the kids responded to my question, what are some things police do for us? They take my daddy. They beat people up. They shoot the bad guys. Their answers were revealing and disturbing. They were simply saying what they have seen. It was obvious to everyone in the room that we have a problem on our hands. And since then, I have even met kids who have been so traumatized by police that they cry and shiver with fear when they see an officer in uniform.
Well, we are... And that's something to leave it on and think about how we can improve things. And David Cooper, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Joy.
David Cooper is the author of Arrested Development, A Veteran Police Chief Sounds Off About Protest, Racism, Corruption, and the Seven Steps Necessary to Improve Our Nation's Police. We will be talking with Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark after we check the latest news. This is the Ideas Network. In the wake of extensive criticism of the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department and its response to the protests resulting after a police officer fatally shot an unarmed teenager, we are taking a look at what good policing looks like this hour and are getting some reaction and analysis of the issues raised in Ferguson. We heard from the former police chief of the Madison Police Department, David Cooper, in our last half hour, who wrote a book on how to improve policing. He advocates community policing, diversifying police departments, a change in mindset where police are viewed as guardians or peacekeepers and not warriors. Now we will get the perspective of Milwaukee County's Sheriff David Clark. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 7:37 on this Friday, August 29th. So what do you think in general of police or law enforcement? Are they doing a good job? What would make it better? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. We are pleased to have with us the Milwaukee County Sheriff, David Clark. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning to your listeners.
I appreciate you being with us. So first off, why don't you just give us your reaction to what happened in Ferguson, Missouri. The Ferguson police response was criticized by many as being too heavy-handed. Do you think it was?
Well, first of all, I don't have all of the facts as they occurred on the ground. Some of that is still being investigated. And all I have really are news reports, so I want to qualify anything that I say. But what we saw unfold is obviously not America's finest hour. It was a tragic event that happened there, and the response, like I said, is under investigation now. But from what we could see, there were certain elements of the community there that weren't happy with the response, and that's important because we derive our authority from the consent of the governed. And so anything that we do, short of an exigent situation, really should have the nod, if you will, from the public. And where that starts, Joy, is creating a relationship. I think the job one is for police departments to create a relationship of trust and respect in those communities, because people will be more willing to participate in keeping their neighborhoods safe. And then the other element, which I think is just as important, is that when something tragic like a police shooting happens, if there's a relationship of trust and respect between the police and the citizens are going to be more willing to give you the benefit of the doubt in those situations.
Yeah. Well, what do you think Ferguson should do moving forward?
Well, again, you know, I'm not from Ferguson, mm-hmm. but just, for, you know, generally, and I know that's what you're asking, but I need to qualify that because in the environment I'm in, people can take things out of context. Mm-hmm. But this is any city USA. First of all, your political leadership has to keep their finger on the pulse of that particular community. And every community is different, which is why I'm not going to say what's good for Ferguson, but what's good for any city, is to make sure that your power structure, your political power structure, is reflective of the city. In other words, you know, it has the same face of the city. It doesn't have to be equal, you know, 50-50 or what have you. But when I read about the changing demographics in Ferguson, in other words, in 1980, Ferguson, Missouri was 85% white. 30 years later, 2010, the city is 70% black. Yet the power structure, and I talk about power, the political power structure, doesn't reflect that changing demographic. And that's where I would put this on the elected officials for not being aware of that. For instance, I heard that they have a school board in Ferguson of 6 members, 5 of which are white, 1 Hispanic. In a city that's 70% black, I find that problematic. So I think it starts there. The police department, I also understand, 53 officers, 3 of which are African-American. I find that problematic because it doesn't reflect the changing demographic of that city. So those are the things externally that people in any city need to pay attention to be more inclusive, to be more diverse, so that the policies that you are enacting as a city or as a police department, that those policies are sensitive to the face of that community, because when people get left out of the policy-making decision, especially those policies that affect them, then that's going to build mistrust, resentment, and anger, and then a flashpoint is set up where, like, a police shooting can serve as that flashpoint to ignite a city. Now, I'm not saying that the rioting and looting that was going on that we saw from television reports is justified because the citizens felt mistrust, resentment, and left out of the process, because nothing justifies that. I'm just showing you how this thing can build to a flashpoint, and then one incident like that can blow things out of proportion.
You said on Fox News last week that Attorney General Eric Holder should apologize to police for his reference regarding mistrust and mutual suspicion in the relationship between law enforcement and communities. Why do you think he should apologize?
Well, I said, first of all, to better qualify it, I said he either needs to further explain what he meant by that or issue an apology to every police officer in America. And I said, he doesn't owe me an apology. I'm a big boy. I'm an elected official. He can criticize me, my agency, whatever. But what a person in a position of leadership like Eric Holder or the governor, and it was a U.S. senator that made some, I thought, inflammatory and irresponsible statements at the time, because the investigation wasn't concluded. And Eric Holder being an accomplished jurist, attorney, and you know, he's got to know better that when an investigation is being conducted, he really should keep his powder dry. And maybe he could go ahead and make some statements like this, for example. I want to make sure that there's a transparent investigation that goes on, that it's objective, that it's complete. All right, you can make statements like that. But when you throw emotion into it, when he said that he basically had been profiled by the police, not in one situation. He named 2 situations, which insinuates that is, you know, there's some nefarious or cultural intent by police officers all across America to go out and deny people their civil rights. And I think, you know what, police officers are not perfect. There's no doubt about that. We're far from it. However, 99%, 99+% of the officers that put on that badge and uniform and risk their lives and go out and serve their community every day do not reflect what Eric Holder said. The other thing I had a problem with when I said that he should further explain is that if that really happened to him and he felt that he had his Fourth Amendment rights violated because, you know, he was pulled over for, in one, a traffic stop, and the other was a field interview stop, Those are seizures under the Fourth Amendment, search and seizure. He'd been seized at that point. And certain things have to kick in. And an attorney knows this. A lawyer knows this. Certain things have to kick in order for the police to go on and conduct that stop. One of them is if they're going to search, they have to have probable cause. All right? And if he said, my car was searched, and I understand the humiliation as I stood there. And then in the other instance in Georgetown, he said he and a friend were going to a movie, and they were stopped, and they remember the indignant treatment, so on and so forth. I thought, and he said at that in that instance, he says, I was a federal prosecutor when that occurred. My thought was, if you felt, especially being a federal prosecutor and knowing the law, that your Fourth Amendment rights were violated, you had a duty. You had a duty to make a complaint with those law enforcement agencies on behalf of not just yourself, if you think, well, it wasn't that big a deal, but on behalf of everybody in America who may have experienced that or who might in the future, to call the police on it, in other words. I encourage people, citizens, to make those complaints if they feel they've been mistreated by a law enforcement officer. And so that's what I meant when I said he needs to further explain, because if he didn't make a complaint and he insinuated his rights were violated under the Fourth Amendment, I would want to ask him, why didn't you make a complaint, Mr. Attorney General?
Yeah. Do you think, Sheriff Clark, that police treat African Americans differently than they do whites?
I reject that notion out of hand, okay? Now, look, there's a general mistrust all across America between police and minority communities. And I'm not going to get into whose fault that is, all right? But it is incumbent upon the police, especially the executive, and I say police because I think this starts at the top. This doesn't start with the street officer. I think it starts with setting a culture at the top, so police administrators, and then that culture will start to trickle down to the officer on the street. Policing in America is very dynamic. It's complex. Things can go very quickly from a person being cooperative and just answering the questions that the police officer is asking. It can go from that in seconds to a violent assault on the police officer. I'm just trying to point out, you know, how quickly this can turn sour on you, okay? So if you look at the way we deploy officers, and this is what I think was one of the things that law enforcement executives need to work on in terms of their deployment strategies. And I heard you talking earlier about the makeup, and I mentioned the two of the Ferguson Police Department, all right? Mm-hmm. Less than 6% officers are black, yet they're working in a city of 70%, that's 70% African-American. Now, that in and of itself, there's nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't reflect the face of that community, which will garner trust. So I look at deployment strategies. When we're shifting officers around, constantly shifting them around, we're doing them a disservice, and we're doing those neighborhoods a disservice. Neighborhoods are diverse. We can't do a one-size-fits-all. But I know this from my 37 years of experience. It takes years to get to know the tendencies, the culture, the law-abiding people, who the law-abiding people are and who the bad guys are in any particular neighborhood. But when we're shifting people around in this, especially that's what we're doing, as it relates to the City of Milwaukee Police Department, that's not my agency, but I spent 24 years there. I know that agency inside and out. But when you're doing these saturation efforts and you're constantly moving officers from one hot spot to another, that might be effective operationally, but it doesn't allow those officers to stay in an area to get to know the people where that relationship of trust and respect can be built that can diffuse a lot of these situations. So if they're there for 2 weeks, and then let's say robberies are occurring on a different part of the city and you remove those officers into that new area, they didn't get to know and didn't get a feel for what's really needed based on what the residents in that community want, and they have to go on to a different situation. And so I think that strategy needs to be looked at and reconsidered because, like I said, it takes years. I worked the streets. I did uniform patrol for 11 years before I went to criminal investigations. And it takes literally years to get to know a neighborhood. I'll give you an example of where that can be effective. Let's say, you know, we hear a lot about the driving while black, they call it, and profiling of traffic stops. Let's say I work a squad area, And I've worked this neighborhood for long enough that I see a car go by and it's got a burnt-out taillight. And I look and I go, oh, that's Mr. Jones's car. He's got a burnt-out taillight. He probably doesn't know it. I know where he lives. I'll stop by tomorrow and I'll say, hey, Mr. Jones, you got to take care of that taillight. That would negate the need for a traffic stop. They'd have to put the takedown lights on, the red and blue lights, and pull them over and say driver's license and registration and all that stuff, which we have to do. But if you know the neighborhood and you look and you go, I know that car over there. Yeah, he's got an expired license plate, but he probably doesn't know. I'll stop and warn him tomorrow or you know, several days from now. Or I can do it later on in my shift if I get a chance. That is the importance of an officer getting to know everything about that neighborhood.
We are talking with David Clark Jr., the Milwaukee County Sheriff, about lessons learned from Ferguson and how to improve law enforcement and policing. And we are welcoming your questions, your views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Milwaukee County's Sheriff David Clark about policing and law enforcement in the wake of the protests and police actions in Ferguson, Missouri. We have full lines, so let's go to Greg in Waukesha first. Hello, Greg.
Hello, Joy. Hello, Sheriff Clark. Sheriff Clark, I respect the work you do, and I respect your humility as well. I talk to a lot of people every day, Joy and Sheriff Clark, and I just feel like there's a lot of mistrust from just the general public, not only felons, you know, but just the general public within police, you know, and I don't know why that is. I am reminded though of a simpler time when several years ago. I'm 36, so I'm not that old, but I'm reminded when police used to hand out baseball cards to children, you know, at parades. And I'm not sure if that, you know, still happens, but when I hear Sheriff Clark talking about building relationships, I guess I want to say one thing is, you know, it starts with the young. You know, if we, you know, help foster that culture of respect when they're young by handing out a baseball card or doing, you know, just getting to know, you know, I mean, it's yeah. Those simple things.
What, a brief reaction to that, Sheriff Clark?
Thanks for the comments, and that caller gets it. You know, little things matter in a relationship. Relationships need to be nurtured, and it's any kind of relationship, family, a marriage, a friendship, a business. The relationship has to be nurtured and based on mutual trust and respect. And it's pretty obvious to me that's absent in many. You know, I'll use something closer to home, the Milwaukee Police Department, where I spent 24 years. That baseball card initiative seemed like a little thing, but it was very effective because it drew young people into law enforcement officers. I remember that program because it was in effect when I was in uniform patrol. And kids would literally run up to the squad car or run up when they see you walking a beat or on your bicycle and say, hey, can I have some baseball cards, officer? And they knew your name. And even if they didn't know your name, it gave you a chance to show the human side of a law enforcement officer. It was a great program. Initially, it was sponsored. It came about with sponsorship because obviously those things cost money. And as time went by, fewer and fewer places were willing to put up the money to sponsor it. But I'll tell you what my organization did. We have a baseball card type program. It doesn't feature baseball players. It features the faces of and different units of my organization. So, for instance, one we have the four, we'll have like four canine officers with their dogs. And then in the back, a little bit about what the canine officers do, what the dogs do, their dog's name. Those are little things, but they matter. So you're right. We got to go back and take a look at the way we're training our officers because we need a culture change within law enforcement so that law enforcement starts acting like the partners that they're supposed to be instead of so much suspicion about the community. And that stuff is necessary, that hypervigilance, that suspicion, because it keeps cops alive.
Thanks, Greg. Joe in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Your guest made a comment, I think, that says a lot when he mentioned about fear of basically of protecting their lives when they go out, police officers. And he's made that several times. I really wonder about where the police draw their candidates. We have such an enormous military system, and a large, besides our police, our prison guards, that it would seem to me that many of the recruits come out of the military, and they come with a mentality, perhaps serving in Afghanistan or Iraq, and this whole idea of protecting their lives. This should not be certainly a comment made of somebody who's coming in to protect a community, that they're already entering it in that mentality of protecting their lives. The other point I'd like
to... I'm sorry, Joe, we're almost out of time, and I would like to ask Sheriff Clark to comment on the militarization, as we hear, of our police departments.
Yeah, this thing needs a lot more debate and discussion. I have said that Congress needs to weigh in on this program, this military surplus program, to make sure that we're doing this judiciously. No one wants to deny officers the training and equipment they need to keep them and their neighborhoods, their cities safe, although that can be a slippery slope and it can get out of hand. A lot of these decisions are being made without public input, and I find that problematic. I think the public needs input into what kind of policing they want for their neighborhoods and their cities. So I said they should probably push the pause button there and start to have public discussion about this move toward, we have to have a clear distinction between cop and soldier here in the United States.
Now, let's take one last call. Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Hi. Yeah, I was just listening to your guest before and getting sort of angrier and angrier, thinking this is a poster for everything that's wrong with policing in America. Hundreds of black men are killed every year. I experienced this in Cincinnati in 2001 when there was a man shot in the back for no good reason, and he was the 16th to die in 3 years. This is an epidemic. The cop in Ferguson needs to be charged with murder, and police need to be held accountable for their actions in the community. And I don't really believe a word he says about...
Well, I'm sorry. We only have a minute to go. Sheriff Clark, what do you think about that?
Well, after I stop laughing, I mean, there's no data to suggest what that caller said. There was a survey done by the Bureau of Justice Statistics, so no one could say that they have any police bias. And they showed in a survey of 40 million stops made by law enforcement officers, they asked the people who were stopped, they did a survey, and only in 1.4% of those 40 million stops was force threatened or was force actually used. So all I'm saying is that the data doesn't suggest what that caller just said. Every shooting or use of force should have a thorough vetting in the United States. And for that caller to call without any foundation and say, hundreds of people are killed by police every year, well, it's just simply not true.
And we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, and thanks to your listeners as well.
David Clark is the Milwaukee County Sheriff. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.